and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. Once again, I am Martin, and I'm joined by the King of the Casters, Mr. Brett Podcast. And Brett, we got to get right to it. Who is our guest?
That's right. Well, I don't know if you like guitar, but I do. And our guest plays a hell of a mean guitar. He plays, you know, with Tokyo Motor Fist. That's the reason that we're here to talk to him. Of course, Trickster is played with Def Leppard, but he's Steve Brown. Steve, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys, and thanks so much for having me on the show. It's a beautiful day in northern New Jersey, so in these crazy times, under the circumstances, life is pretty fucking good right now.
Nice.
Well, that's all we can ask for, and of course, life is going to get even better, because on July 10th, the Tokyo Motor Fist Lions album is coming out, so I think that's a reason to be excited.
It is, man. I couldn't be more excited because I honestly believe Tokyo Motor Fist Lions, it's my best musical work to date, and I just can't wait for the world to hear it, man. Guitar solos for days, huge melodic choruses, big drums, big bass, Ted Poley, Greg Smith, Chuck Berge. It's, you know, it's melodic rock perfection in my book.
Well, there's no question about it. And I mean, when you consider it, you've done some amazing albums in your career. So for you to say that, that's pretty damn high praise. But it's an awesome album. So everybody who loves the melodic rock genre, they need to listen to this.
You said it, man. You said it. That's right.
No, it just always amazes me just how underrated Ted Poley is. He's absolutely one of the best.
He is. Ted's fantastic. You know, and again, you know, Ted grew up a couple towns away from me in northern New Jersey here. He grew up in Ramsey, New Jersey. I'm from Paramus, and I'd known Ted when he was the drummer and part-time singer in this great New Jersey band called Prophet, which I don't know if your listeners are aware of, but they were a great band, you know, in central Jersey that had the great Dean Fasano as the lead singer, who used to play in Message with Richie Sambora. So one of these early 80s, mid-80s bands, and, you know, and then I met Ted, you know, I became friendly with him right when he got the Danger gig, and it was really cool to see him, you know, see those guys get signed and go on to the success that they had. And a funny story, he actually asked me at one point to join Danger, but I was too far and deep with Trickster, and Trickster was my band. And, you know, and here we are, you know, 30 years later playing, you know, talking about Tokyo Motor Fist and our second record. But Ted does a phenomenal job. He takes what I give him vocally, you know, because I sing all the songs first and then I give him a work track to work with. And he takes it and he makes every song his own, as does Greg Smith on bass and Chuck Berge on drums. So that's what, you know, really makes this a band effort.
Yeah. What is your songwriting, style? Is it lick first, music first, and then lyrics? Or is it concept, or, you know, how do you usually write your songs?
All of the above, just what you said. I have no real method to my madness. You know, I play guitar and I'm singing every day. I'm always writing. It's 24/7, all 365 days a year. I never stop. You know, I've been blessed. I have a beautiful house with a great recording studio that I've had in my house for 27 years. So as much as I love playing live, I'm also a studio geek. You know, I love being in the studio. Mutt Lang is probably one of my, you know, all-time idols. So it's always that, you know, that I kind of judge everything on. Hey, man, what would Mutt Lang do? What would Def Leppard do? What would Bruce Fairburn do? Bon Jovi? What would Ted Templeman do with Van Halen? You know, so it's really, really cool to be able to do that. So the songwriting process, you know, comes from all different ideas. Sometimes I hear something cool and I go, fuck, that's a great song title, or a melody pops in my head. And, you know, so I learned a long time ago, throw away the rule book and just do what comes natural. And, you know, like I tell everybody, man, I've been telling this story for years, Give It To Me Good, my biggest hit with Trickster, that song basically wrote itself. I think I wrote that song in a matter of 15 or 20 minutes. And, you know, it's a song that changed my life as well as, you know, the guys in the band. And, you know, I think I've been given a God-given talent of being able to write songs, lyrics, melodies, phrasing on, you know, phrasing for great guitar riffs. And, you know, of course, it's a tip of the hat to all my influences, you know, Van Halen, Kiss, Cheap Trick, Bon Jovi, Motley Crue, all those influenced songwriters. And again, Mutt Lang and producers like Bruce Fairburn. You put all that stuff together and here we are.
So is that then the house that the Trickster's second album here wound up buying you?
Yeah, well, there you go. I love that. I love that, man. That phrase is getting that little quote of mine's getting a lot of mileage. But yeah, I mean, you know, a little bit of both. I mean, I did very well with the, you know, we all did. We had good success, and I think the other guys were relatively smart with their money. I sure as hell know I was, and you know, blessed, man. You know, it's the couple hit songs and publishing and songwriting royalties. It's the gift that keeps on giving. But yeah, man, I've been blessed, and yeah, I definitely think the $1 million here record deal that we negotiated for the second record, certainly, you know, one of the reasons why I'm blessed with this beautiful castle that I'm in. It's not a castle. I'm fucking joking, but I like to think it is.
Well, I'm interested then, because of course you just signed a new deal with Frontiers to release Lions. So is that the kind of case where you're just going one album at a time with them?
Pretty much. I mean, look, I think, you know, somebody asked me this before as well. I think we signed like a 3-album deal, but it's all, look, man, we just go one at a time. We don't know who's going to be here tomorrow. You know, I don't live my life that way. You know, I'm just enjoying the moment right now, but we'll see. You know, we've talked about it. I've talked about it with the guys. I would like to have a nice, you know, hey man, 3's a charm for Tokyo Motor Fist, but you know, dude, we're not getting any younger here. You know, I'm enjoying the last couple days of being in my 40s. I'm going to be 50 on July 13th. So, you know, and the other guys are a bit older than I am, and Chuck is a lot older. So we don't know what's going to happen. And, but with that being said, if I was a betting man, I would think there's going to be a 3rd Tokyo Motor Fist record.
What's the difference then between, you know, playing with Tokyo Motor Fist versus playing with Trickster, even versus playing with Def Leppard?
Well, the difference is, I mean, it's a different group of guys, so it's a different dynamic. You know, the cool thing about Tokyo Motor Fist is it is a real band. It's not one of these Frontiers or Golden Robot fake, you know, super groups, these guys that never play in the same room together, never even meet each other or whatnot, and make these records. And I get why people have to do it, but, you know, it kind of gets annoying after a while, you know, when you see these bands and you see like major rock stars do these records and they don't even write the songs. You know, they got a producer writing the songs and shit like that. So this is a real genuine band, you know, that plays live shows where, you know, we would have been playing a lot more shows this year. We had dates in Japan booked, but this is a real thing, and it feels, you know, it has the same kind of energy when Trickster was going full steam. You know, you have 3 other guys that are equally as committed to it, and, you know, sadly we all have sort of our day jobs, you know, Chuck most importantly playing with Billy Joel, you know, so he can't really commit to anything long term with Tokyo Motor Fist. So we have to kind of do spot dates, if you will. But, you know, he's always said if something great comes along, you know, like, hey man, if we were invited on the stadium tour with Leppard and Motley Crue to open that, I think Chuck would have been able to open up his schedule a little bit, if you know what I mean.
I would hope so.
So yeah, man, but I love playing with these guys. We have great chemistry, and it's, again, it's very low pressure on everybody, you know, and we're just, again, we're looking forward, you know, it's a, you know, unprecedented times we're living in right now. We all know 2020 was supposed to be the biggest year of rock and roll touring in history, and that's all blown to shit. And who knows what's even going to happen in 2021, because we all know we can't do big rock shows, stadium rock shows with 50,000 people if there's not a vaccine. So let's pray and let's all do what we can to make sure that everybody in the world, and especially in America, stays safe and healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's weird because there's so much desire to get back into regular life and to get back out on tour and to get back into these shows. But if you can't do it safely, then it's just not a good idea, because then we're just extending the dates, you know, and nobody wants that.
No, and that's exactly what you see what's happening in Arizona, Texas, Georgia, Florida. You know, and those are big rock and roll places, you know, big rock and roll states. So, man, people, wake the fuck up. Wear your mask.
Now, you talk about being, you know, 24/7, 365, always on. So then when you're writing, I mean, there's 11 songs on Lions, there's 11 songs on the first Tokyo Motor Fist. Did you create more songs or were you kind of locked in on the ones that you wanted to put on the album?
There's always more songs, guys. I've had this studio for 27 years. I probably have enough vaulted unreleased material for 20 records, and you know the songs would blow you away. I'm in the process of like digitizing everything that I have and transferring, so I'm going to tell you right now, within the next 10 years you're going to see a hell of a lot of music coming from me and you know whatever other bands I put together, because I really love this thing that Frontiers offers me, and I you know I'm in the process of possibly putting together another sort of all-star band, because it honestly is so cool to be able to work with people that you normally wouldn't get the opportunity to do. So you know, again, as long as it's done the right way, I don't have a problem with it, you know. But you know, again, like I said, when bands aren't writing their songs, and you can obviously tell that it's a cash grab, it's a different thing. But yes, there are always extra songs, but those go to other projects. Those go to other artists, whether I'm doing music for TVs and TV shows and films. But for this, it was pretty much I was on such a roll and came up, you know, these were all brand new songs. Some of the riffs I've had laying around, the riff to Decadence on 10th Street, that, you know, the intro riff I probably had for 20 years. The riff for Sedona, PJ from Trickster, actually, he was listening to the record last week. He came in and he said, dude, that riff in Sedona, weren't you playing that at Soundcheck in 1990? And I'm like, yes, I was. It took me fucking 30 years to finally get it on record. But you know what? Better late than never, right?
Well, and it's interesting because Sedona is probably my favorite track on the album. I love the groove, and I just love the little like kind of jazz funk vibe going on, especially at the end.
Oh, totally, man. It's a total, you know, it's like I tell people, it's like Toto meets Van Halen. You know, if you put that together with the horns, we got kind of the Aerosmith extreme, get the funk out horns on it. And what's even cooler is we were able to get Chuck's bandmate, my good friend Mark Rivera from the Billy Joel band and Ringo Starr's band, to play the sax solo on it. And that's who that is.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. There's no question. I mean, like, when you have so much talent, then it's wonderful to see the kind of things that you can actually put out. And now with your guitar, what's it like to kind of create the solos, and like, what's your mindset for creating a guitar solo?
It's kind of the same that it's always been. Look, I'm influenced, of course, by the King, Ed Van Halen, my good friend. And, you know, he's the be all end all for me. It started out, that's what I loved, you know, Ace Frehley, Rick Nielsen, simple melodic guitar solos in a sense. But then, you know, in the 80s, you know, you got Ed, Randy Rhodes, Steve Vai, Warren DeMartini, Jakey Lee, Dino Lynch. I loved all those guys. And the coolest thing about all of them, Phil Collin, the coolest thing about all of them, Richie Sambora. You listen to these great solos in Living on a Prayer, Photograph, Jump, you know, they're melodic, yet they tell a story. So my whole thing I learned early on, and you could hear it in the early Trickster solos, listen to the solo to One in a Million. It's kind of a song within a song, and it has its own voice. Instead of a bunch of notes and just fucking playing as fast as you can, you're taking the song to a new place. So I'm always a big believer in the guitar solo's got to have emotion. I love to have, again, the shred, you know, the shred-alicious licks in there. And then also, most importantly, melodic, because you want people to be able to sing along with it. And I think that that's where, you know, again, this record to me has certainly some of my best guitar work that I've ever done. And I'm just so happy for it. And, you know, I love guitar. And I still, like I say, man, I still practice every day like I did when I was 13 years old. So it's a love of the instrument that takes me to this place.
You really were so young in those early days of Trickster. Do you ever go back and listen to the full discography and kind of, you know, how do you feel about it now that you're older and you have more experience on the guitar?
Well, it's awesome, you know, and it's funny that you said that because I've been transferring for the last, you know, while we've been in this pandemic, I've been making great use of the time and sort of preserving my history and cataloging everything. So I've been transferring all of the old Trickster demo cassettes and our first original recording that we ever did from 1986. I got the 8-track analog tape and I've been transferring all that. And man, it is unreal listening to it and hearing songs that I forgot about. Like I got tapes and, like, you know, PJ and I have been getting, you know, compiling all of our stuff and I go, oh my God, I forgot about this song. How cool is that? Listening back to it, you know, of course the perfectionist in me goes, damn, I could have done that better, you know? And so we all have that sort of thing in us, but I just remember it again. I say it all the time, dude, I'm living the dream. I lived the dream 30 years ago, 35 years ago. I'm still living it. So to listen back, it's like I'm so fond of those times and so grateful that whatever, it's incredible. The coolest thing I will tell you is what I'm so thankful of is that in this digital age that we live in now, young kids will never get the chance to make records the way we made records back in the 80s and early 90s, working in with 2-track analog tape, working in legendary studios like Sound City in LA, The Village, The Enterprise, you know, Right Track Recording, and all these incredible studios making records the way Van Halen used to make records, the way Def Leppard made records. You're never going to get that again. So again, so thankful that we were able to be a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, those old days, like so many, you know, there's so much to wish that you could go back to. But then, of course, you look at the Sunset Strip and you realize that that kind of thing could never happen again. So it's so hard. But of course, it's easy to glamorize, I think.
Of course it is. Yeah. But I will tell you this, man. I enjoyed every moment and I live, you know, I kind of live my life in the sense, you know, that song that I wrote years ago, Live for the Day. That's kind of the way I live my life. And, you know, though I've given up the rock and roll party lifestyle, I'm 14 months sober, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, back in the day, every opportunity, man, whether we had a day off, any city I was in, PJ and I, we would go to the zoo. We would go to the beach. We would do this while other guys were sitting in their hotel room. We were out. We enjoyed every moment. We were making the first record, going to the Sunset Strip, man. I was there. I saw all that stuff that you see in the documentaries and stuff about bands putting up flyers with the staple gun. And then another band come up a minute later, rip down their flyer and put their flyer up. It was fucking dog eat dog. But I'm so, again, it's one of those things, man, talking to you guys. The whole thing from 1983 to here we are now, my life, my career, every dream I ever had came true 100 times over. So it's the best, you know. And so I don't look back on people go, oh, man, don't you wish your record came out 3 years earlier and you guys would have sold 10 million records? Yeah, of course, that would have been great. But you know what? I'll take what I was given because we all know how many musicians. Dude, I'm part of the 1%. You know what I mean? Who have had that success. How many musicians never even get an opportunity to do any of it? And I did it all. So, dude, I'm just blessed 100 times over.
Well, it's funny because I remember, you know, now 30 years ago when the Trickster album, the first Trickster album came out, I certainly remember the cover. And I actually had to travel into the United States to buy the Trickster album because it wasn't available in Canada yet. So yeah. It was just one of those cases where, and I remember being on the plane and popping that first album on into my Walkman at the time. So, I mean, you know, fantastic stuff. I mean, that's the kind of thing that burned into my memory now.
Yeah. And that, you know, exactly what you said. That was one of the biggest issues that we had to deal with the success of the first record, because, you know, with everybody listening, that record should have been 10, you know, I'm not going to say 10 times as popular, but we should have sold 2 million records on that. Our record company, they did the best they could. We had the worst distribution in the world that you could ever imagine. I remember when our video, Give It to Me Good, was number one on MTV. We were playing in Ohio, and the next day we went to the mall. and there were three record stores in the mall. You know, can you imagine that? That's back in 1990, man. There were three record stores. Only one of them had our record at the time.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, and we went in, PJ and I, man, and we were steaming. We were number one. You know, if we were on Geffen Records, and Don Kolodner told our manager and told me this, if we were on Geffen Records, you guys would have sold 2.5 million records. And I believe that. You know, we owned, you know, from October of 1990 till May of 1991, we owned MTV, man. Number, every video, Give It To Me Good was number one for 13 weeks. One in a Million was number one for 8 weeks, and Surrender was number one for 2 weeks. So it's just one of those things, man. You know, again, but you know what? Who gives a fuck? It is what it is. You can't change it. So again, so thankful that we were given even a little piece of that pie, if you know what I mean.
Do you have any stories of, you know, the record companies or anybody coming to you with some crazy promotional idea or crazy video idea that you just thought, what the hell is this?
Well, Give It To Me Good, when we were gonna, when we got the green light to do our first video, it was back, and of course, back in the day when there was the video treatments and the video directors, and everybody would come up with these crazy, you know, stories and stuff like that. And so we got the treatment, this one treatment that was actually seriously under consideration, you know, and it was like, it was like a spaghetti Western thing. It was like, you know, it was Pete riding in on a horse and, you know, doing, it was like almost like Rat with the Wanted Man thing, you know, and I was just like, this is completely fucking whack, man. This is, I didn't dig it at all. And our managers and our record company guy, this guy, Steve Sinclair, and us, most of all, we were, you know, our, the Trickster thing, whether you liked it or not, it was real, you know. And again, like I say this all the time, whatever we lacked in technical proficiency, whatever Pete lacked in being a pitch perfect singer or whatnot, you know, we were rough around the edges, but we were real. And so the thing we wanted to show everybody was that we were different than everybody else. We, as much as I love Warrant and Poison, we weren't getting dressed up like that. We were wearing jeans and t-shirts, and we were just real teenagers from New Jersey that would hang out at the diner, that would ride dirt bikes in between, you know, practice and music. And so we believed that that was the right move, and everybody, our managers and our record company people, went to MCA, and, you know, we battled with them and told them this is what we want to do. And, you know, and we did it, and we found this great director, and we basically documented sort of a day in the life of Trickster, and the rest is history for us, because it worked and it resonated with the kids. Because look, there are a lot of other bands, I'm not dumb, I know this, that got signed around the same time as us, bands that were on our label that were technically better than us as musicians, but they didn't have better songs, I can tell you that. But what they didn't have was the uniqueness. And look, at that time, man, those, the hair metal bands, the hard rock bands, were dime a dozen. The ones that succeeded were the ones that were unique, I think, you know, and offered something else. So, I mean, it was Trickster and Firehouse, the last two bands to break from that genre. So, you know, kind of says it right there.
For sure. And, well, and of course, making music videos now is so different, of course, as you guys know. I mean, like, you got the fantastic music video with video for the new song, and I mean, I love seeing the music videos now, but you know what a difference, right?
Well, what a difference! What a difference, and what a cost, man! Give It To Me Good cost $180,000 to make. One in a Million video cost $250,000. The Surrender video, this is a fucking good one. And that video, I mean, I love it for what it is. We used Madonna's director. It was like the record company forced it down our throat. Fucking cost us $350,000. And that's half recoupable. We had to pay that shit back. And I was like, man, we didn't even get to shower before that video.
Oh,
we were on the Scorpions tour, and we had to drive up from wherever we were, North Carolina. We had to drive to Brooklyn. We got to the soundstage, and I'm like, okay, cool. Where's the shower? The director, one of the assistants, like, there are no showers here. And I was like, I can't even fucking take a shower before making this video. So basically, we rolled out of the tour bus, and here we are making a $350,000 video. Unreal.
Oh man, that's well. I mean, the stories. Of course, I'm sure you can tell stories for days, and I know we'd love to hear them. But I also know that we're running near the end of our time with you. So, once again, you should tell the fans where they can find Lions, of course, on July 10th, and how they can keep in touch with you.
Well, the record's out, going to be out. You can find it, of course, in all the digital outlets. I believe Amazon and wherever. Just search for it. And again, it to me, it's and everybody, the critics and the fans that have heard the clips already hailing it as the melodic rock record of the year. And I agree with that. And most of all, it's got a great message of positivity. And in these times we're living in, this record will certainly, it's not going to change your life. It's not going to pay your bills, but what it will do will take you away from your problems and make you feel good. If you're a fan of great rock and roll, Trickster, Danger, Van Halen, Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Motley Crue, Kiss, Cheap Trick, put this record in and you're going to fall in love. And that's it. Steve Brown Rocks at Instagram and Twitter and wherever else you want to find me. You can always, it's not that hard nowadays.
Well, yeah, I mean, because if you want to sing along with something, well, then Lions is, you're going to be able to sing along with Lions. Absolutely.
Totally, man. And guys, thank you for having me on. And to all the listeners out there, thank you for over 30 years of love and support. And I wouldn't be here without you. So thanks again.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. And here's to another 30 years and beyond. So, all the best in the future. And we look forward to talking to you again.
That's it, brother. And one last thing. Happy Canada Day to you guys.
Hey, thank you very much. Very nice.
I have a lot of Canadian friends. Chris Jericho, Chris Irvine is one of my best friends. I love that guy, a great Canadian, and Phil X from Bon Jovi. So all the great Canadians out there, all you guys, I love you, and we had some great times up in Canada, man. First night of the Striper tour in 1990, our first tour ever was at Rock and Roll Heaven in Toronto. So Canada is always near and dear to my heart.
Awesome. Well, hopefully you get the chance to come back up here and we get the chance to see you guys live.
Okay, guys, take it easy. Gotta roll. Rock and roll. Bye.
Bye now.
The drive.